Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry.
Hi everyone, it's Ben Jackson here. We've never formally announced this, but you've probably noticed that I've joined the show as a co-host recently, and it's been such a pleasure to come and share our guests with you and with Alyssa every week. Well, this week, Alyssa and I alone are going to be having one of our regular check-ins, where we get to share our thoughts on a range of really important issues. So I hope you'll sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
She's in the public eye. She's the one that chose this road. So everything in her life should be public. What do you say to people like that?
Oh, that's a very ignorant way to see life.
In response to the growing use of artificial intelligence, AI, for content creation, YouTube has implemented new guidelines for labeling videos generated or significantly altered with AI tools.
Who created that bogus robocall with President Biden's voice that appeared out of thin air, telling people not to vote in the New Hampshire primary? The incident just enraged local election officials, and Biden allies quickly became the subject of a multi-state law enforcement investigation.
In Gaza City, this is what imminent famine looks like. Thousands of Palestinians crowd a UN warehouse. The women up front, they wait for an 11-pound bag of flour like their lives depend on it, because they do.
Alyssa, welcome back to the show. And I thought, like, every once in a while, we'd like to use your show to just talk about stuff that's happening in the world, because we do a lot of bringing experts on and talking about that kind of stuff. But we don't have a lot of episodes that cover a lot of things, right? We focus in on little things, but there's a lot happening in the world. We can't get to it all of the time with experts. So I like these chats that we do once in a while.
And we get to give our own opinions. Lord knows we're both opinionated.
Not me. I have no opinions on anything. I'm completely neutral. So I wanted to start today by talking a little bit about something that I think you'll have personal experience with. And this week, after a whole lot of wild and rampant speculation, Kate Middleton announced that she was diagnosed with cancer. And I don't want to talk at all about Kate Middleton, not even a little bit. I think that the amount of attention we're paying there is its own problem. But that's what I want to talk about, is the idea that public people are not entitled to private lives. That people like you, other celebrities, there's a part of our culture that feels like they are entitled to your lives. And I remember being with you in Los Angeles a year or so ago, and we had gone to see your daughter's soccer game. And when we left, we had to dodge paparazzi. You were there at your daughter's soccer game. No one's ever going to follow me around, right? Like, that's never going to be a thing that I have to deal with. But how do you feel about that? Do you think that your private life is up for conversation for these people, for dissection by people who don't know you?
In the best of circumstances, no. But I am fully aware that any window being left open for speculation about anything that might be happening, if you aren't completely transparent, or if you don't face things head on, I mean, you see it all the time. Everybody needs me to make a statement about everything. It's like, I don't know that I even can make a statement on certain things that they want. And even if I did, they would take the opposing view anyway.
And I will tell you, I pay a lot of attention to your social media, and I see you make a statement about something and somebody will come in your comments and say, oh, that's great. Why haven't you made a statement about this? And if they go back two or three posts, you have a statement about that, right? They're not even paying attention to it. It's about the how can I tear you down thing that we all seem to have in us.
And I think that the internet brings that out, because it's very easy to sit behind a keyboard and be a keyboard warrior. But I do know that I have spent most, if not all of my life in the public eye. I'm lucky enough that I did not spend my 20s in a cell phone society with a social media platform for people to upload shit. I don't know. It's a different time. I'm raising my kids much differently. Milo has a very interesting outlook on all of it, you know, because after this stupid thing with Cooperstown, by the way, that's a perfect example of, if I did pay for my son's entire team to go to Cooperstown, they would have had a problem with that too.
Of course they would have.
Like, oh, so entitled, you know, your son doesn't have to work for anything, blah, 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 blah.
Right. Why didn't you pay for like Milwaukee's team to go to Cooperstown, right?
Exactly. That weekend, Milo volunteered at an adoption center for animals and paparazzi followed us and they became a whole article about how I was driving a $250,000 Porsche, which I don't think my car was that much money. Honestly, I don't know. It's a lease. It's not their business, but also Milo was like, so what, mom? And I think because he's the generation that it is like everything is on the internet, to him, these things don't mean, it's not the same magnitude for his generation because everybody lives their lives on social media. So for him, it's great. Paparazzi got a picture of us getting into your Porsche. Cool.
Large aggressive men swarm us, causing a mob scene, yelling, jockeying for position, crowding around the kids while running over other parents and children unfortunate enough to be nearby. My 17-month-old baby is terrified and cries. My 4-year-old says, why do these men never smile? Why do they never go away? Why are they always with us? And then there are violent, mentally ill stalkers who can now get close to my kids by simply following mobs of photographers and blending in.
He doesn't see that as being a problem or problematic at all because we've also raised him to know that, and this is true for everyone, not just celebrity kids. At any point, someone could be taking a video on their phone of you doing something dumb. So don't do dumb shit.
I admit that I am biased because I love your kids like family, but your kids are amazing and they roll with shit in a way that many kids don't, probably because of how you're raising them and the world that they've grown up in. But people target your kids.
Those people are disgusting. Those people that commented on Milo's social media, like, your mom is a baby killer and blah, blah, blah. I was like, really?
Yeah. Well, just for the record, if you're listening and you're one of those people, I have involved people's families and pastors and employers with those comments that I see. I am not letting you get away with it because it sickens me so much that I will try and tear down your life if I see you doing it. Don't be that person.
Don't be that person just not to be that person. It's just so gross.
What do you think social media companies' roles are in that, right? Because this happens on social. The kids are going to be social. Not just your kids, everybody's kids. Anyone who says something on the internet is potentially a target for this and their families are potentially target for this. What role do you think like Instagram or YouTube or Twitter have in trying to police this?
We have to do something to protect our young people from social media. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's about Instagram creating like a youth version where they can have stricter policies or whatever, but something definitely needs to be done. I was on TikTok the other day and I was sitting there thinking about somehow I've ended up on a feed where it's all young people struggling with cancer or some kind of illness and sharing like every moment of pushing their nutrition into a tube. And I'm just thinking, is it good that that is normalized through social media? Or is it glamorizing or romanticizing illness in a way that's unhealthy for kids to be exposed to? And is that just an ableist thought in general?
I raised a daughter that had that, right? My daughter, and she's fine with me talking about this. We've had this conversation a lot, so I'm not spilling anything out of school here. But my daughter had really serious health conditions, including having to put nutrition through a tube. And she made a choice to be personally pretty private about it, except on occasions where she felt like she could use her voice in a way that might change things. Like there's a National Rare Disease Day, and on that day, she tends to post more about it. Or that when there are therapy animals that need help or fundraising or that kind of stuff, she talks about it and the impact that therapy animals had on her. But I think that for what I think about when I see those is that many of these young people, their entire social life is now through social media because those illnesses, many of them cannot have visitors in person. They cannot have relationships, or because of bias against them, they're not afforded the opportunity to have relationships. And so the relationships tend to be public, visible. And I don't know overall if it's healthy or not, but I know that taking it away from them would be horrible.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
That makes a lot of sense. And it goes to that thing of that, is social media generally good or is it bad? Is it a bad force or is it good? I mean, the obvious spreading of misinformation, huge issue. The predatory nonsense that goes on social media is very dangerous for young people. I have theories that anxiety with young girls are through the roof right now because there is no safe place for them. It used to be we could be in our homes and feel safe and like we weren't going to be harassed, but that's not even true now because you open up your DMs and you're still not safe. As women, as young girls, we're in this cycle of there is no shelter. I remember when I published Hacktivist, my graphic novels, Jack Dorsey wrote my intro and he was basically about tools being used for good or bad. And how every tool can be used for either, right? Like a hammer, you could build a home with, but you could also bludgeon someone in the head and commit homicide with a hammer. So it's all how it's regulated. And I know that when you say the word regulation, people get all upset. But listen, they're regulating our fucking bodies now. So what do you think of the whole TikTok legislation that passed?
I'll tell you, Steven Mnuchin, who was Trump's Treasury Secretary, wants to buy TikTok. I am much, much more concerned about Mnuchin as a national security threat than I am about China.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is here. He joins us now. There is so much to talk about: the markets, inflation, the White House's new budget plan, TikTok. You just closed the capital infusion deal for New York Community Bancorp. Former Treasury Secretary is the founder and managing partner of Liberty Strategic Capital. I think we should start with TikTok, because I think we're all trying to understand what's happening here, whether it should be banned, divested, or otherwise. And if it is divested, who may be a potential buyer?
Well, you know, when I was Treasury Secretary, I chaired CFIUS, and CFIUS approved, and I had President Trump sign an order that TikTok had to be sold. And I continue to believe that. So I think the legislation should pass. And I think it should be sold. I understand the technology. It's a great business. And I'm going to put together a group to buy TikTok.
Wait, if he has that money, shouldn't he be putting up Trump's bond?
You would think, because Trump doesn't have it, apparently.
If Mnuchin has enough money to buy TikTok, people that are that wealthy should not be in government at all.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree that that's not who should be ruling us. But the problem is it costs so much money to run for office that these are the people who are funding it. These are the people who get appointed to positions. And you don't have people who are qualified. And I don't think we can set a wealth ceiling. But I think that we have to do something that makes it easier for people who don't have that money to get involved with government. I think about, do you remember Paul Wellstone? He was a senator from Minnesota, really liberal senator, who died in a plane crash. And this would have been in like early, mid-2000s. And Paul Wellstone was the only member of the United States Senate who got a pay raise when he took the job. And the United States senators are not poorly paid positions, right? None of those people are making a small salary. And so you think of the fact that people are in the Senate, they're taking jobs that are a multiple of the average income in the United States, and they're all taking pay cuts to get that job. That's a real problem, because how the hell are they going to actually understand the kitchen table issues that we have? And I will say there are people like Elizabeth Warren, who I really do believe get it. I think Sherrod Brown in Ohio really gets it. He understands it, even though they have money that we don't have. They haven't always had that money. And they also care enough about the issues that people are paying to that it's not about themselves. But I also look at people like Joe Manchin and Joe Manchin's yacht. And these are people who are ostensibly on the side of labor, who are not doing this particular work. And I think that's really problematic. And when these people then who are so far from the public are trying to say that TikTok should be banned, and to be fair, There may be things that the intelligence committees know that we don't know. There may be ways that TikTok is using this to, or China could use this to harm the United States. But I don't know how they would be doing it in a way that other nations are not manipulating other social media companies to do that, right? I don't see how it's any particular immediate kind of risk that Twitter doesn't provide.
Yeah, look, is it any different than how Russia infiltrated our elections in 2016? Is it because of ownership? It must be the ownership. Because otherwise, if it's because they're worried about influence, that happens everywhere.
It does happen everywhere. What I think it is that it's really politically popular right now to say CCP and evil in the same thing. And people just believe it, right? But maybe there is some risk there. And if there is some risk there, I think there are things they can do to mitigate it other than forcing the sale to an American oligarch, right? I think that it's not like they're making it a publicly traded company that people immediately have on. You're going to have another right-wing megalomaniac in charge of a major social media network. And we look what's happened with Twitter when that happened.
Oh my God, he has lost his mind. Did you watch that Don Lemon interview?
I watched a part of it, and I nearly deleted all of everything that I've ever had on Twitter. I had to walk away from it.
I mean, it was, if anyone out there is listening has not watched the interview with Elon Musk and Don Lemon, which resulted in Don Lemon's contract that he had with X being canceled, like you couldn't write it in a script. It was so twisted. Twisted is the word that I can think of. Not to jump off of this, but I don't want to give Elon too much time. But let's talk about the Supreme Court social media case. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so there have been a bunch of cases about the Supreme Court and social media, including Florida and Texas are trying to pass laws saying that social media companies cannot delete content based on the views expressed in that content. So, for example, DeSantis and the jerk in Texas, Greg Abbott, are trying to have endorsed laws in their state saying that social media companies cannot delete posts, cannot moderate content based on the views expressed in that content, so that they have to be a free, open market for any kind of speech that comes across that and any violation of this free speech. And I will tell you, these companies are private companies. And it's akin to, in my view, and I'm not a lawyer, so what the hell do I know? But in my view, it's akin to going on to someone's private property and holding a Klan rally. The people who own that private property in Florida are even allowed to shoot those people that come onto their property without permission, right? And Florida is saying social media companies can't say, you can't come and do that in my business. And I think that's preposterous. So those are things. But the case that was this week, Louisiana, Missouri, and some other states have gone to the Supreme Court trying to say that the Biden administration, which has leaned on companies like Twitter to remove posts that spread disinformation about elections, about health things like coronavirus, about deepfakes using AI, right? And they've gone to these companies saying you have to take them down. These states are saying that's a suppression of free speech, and the Biden administration is not allowed to do that.
The Supreme Court today heard oral arguments in a First Amendment case experts say could have implications for the 2024 election. Murphy versus Missouri is a lawsuit against the Biden administration. It focuses on the government's communications with social media companies and whether the alleged conduct went too far in trying to counter disinformation online.
And up until now, appeals courts have agreed largely with the states, although Supreme Court seems to be surprisingly more on the side of the Biden administration on this. We'll see what the ruling comes, but they seem to be leaning towards, of course, the government has an interest.
It's a public health issue.
It's a national security issue. It's all of these things. And the government has a vested interest in preventing that stuff from happening. But broadly, the people doing that tend to be on the extreme right, which is where Texas and Florida and the GOP presently is. And they see a political benefit to this. And so therefore, they're trying to scream free speech, when we all know it's not free speech in any way that free speech was envisaged. It doesn't pass the smell test, let alone any legal theory.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. Of course it is. And this is not just a Republican thing. There's a strategist for Dean Phillips, the congressman who was running against Biden on the left. A contractor for him created a deep fake of President Biden telling New Hampshire voters not to go and write him in during the Democratic primary, and sent that out as a robocall to New Hampshire voters. And New Hampshire voters are now suing that strategist for that particular deepfake. But this is a real national security thing. Imagine that happening where on an election day, you get a phone call from a reverse 911 call that's deepfake saying that there is a mass shooter at the polls and stay home today. Imagine what happens. And they target districts for this. This is a real thing that I think that has really important national security issues.
How have we not seen this coming? You and I have been talking about AI and deepfakes for years on this podcast. Now we are here. We are here. We are in the technology. It's looking good. You can put it out there. It doesn't look unrealistic. And I think up to this point, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think YouTube is the only company that is making people, users, label AI.
Yeah. So they've recently, just in the last week or so, come out with a policy that says users who make, quote, realistic AI have to label it as such. And I think that is such a half measure because A, it's self-reported, right?
But isn't it better than nothing?
Yeah, it's better than nothing. But the people who are doing this maliciously are not going to play by the rules and say this is deepfake, right? And so can YouTube police that? I would say that based on their policing of already false information and their failed sort of ability to police hate speech and harassing comments, which, by the way, they use AI to detect hate in their comments. And you and I both know what happens when you report comments that are immediately hateful. There's no violation that comes back on them. I think that it's good that they're talking about it. I work as a professor, and when work is submitted to me, it goes through an AI filter, and it tells me whether or not they think it's AI. And I have to use my own human judgment before I come to that, but it's a nice backup for me. And you would think that there would be something like that on content as it hits the platform before it becomes public, where it goes into a, okay, these are potentially AI, they need to have human eyes on them, rather than we're just going to put everything up and then let's see if the AI can catch it after. But that takes an investment in humans. And what AI's potential is from a business standpoint is the exact opposite. We don't have to invest in humans anymore.
It appears that Biden and Trump have locked down their nominations. I don't know how Trump is allowed to run for president. I still don't get it.
Can I make an unpopular argument about that? Right now, I believe what the Congress should have done, they should have convicted Trump and made it impossible, disqualified him from running. Congress had the responsibility to do that. A majority of the Senate voted to convict Trump in his second impeachment, but not the 67 senators that you needed to do that or whatever. And so the Senate abdicated its responsibility, and that was Congress's responsibility to do that. But we absolutely cannot pass laws that prevent people who have been convicted of crimes from holding federal office, or who have been charged with crimes from holding federal office. And the reason we can't do that is Martin Luther King. And Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, they're all convicted of crimes. They would be disqualified from office. You would be disqualified from office, you know, if you have a misdemeanor, depending on how far they went, right? You were arrested protesting. Maybe that's a civil infraction. I'm not sure exactly where that went. But you think about that, people who use free speech and peaceful resistance.
I think there's a difference between that, and I feel like that difference can be stipulated, right? You can't run for office if you tried to overturn the government. You can't run for office if you've tried to sway an election. Don't you feel like there are lines that can be drawn that aren't civil rights issues, right?
I do think that, but what if they said, well, Martin Luther King marching across Selma's Bridge was an attempt to overthrow the government? What if they said clamping down on disinformation was an attempt to overthrow the right of free speech and therefore it's a thing? Like, what's to stop, once you have that law, the megalomaniac, the Trump, from abusing that law to keep his opponents from running for office?
For hardworking Americans, November 5th will be our new Liberation Day, but for the liars and cheaters and fraudsters and censors and imposters who have commandeered our government, it will be their judgment day. Their judgment day.
That's what I worry about. And I agree with you. I would say, okay, people who are convicted of rape should not be allowed to run for office. That's what I believe. But then how long before you get some corrupt sheriff's department who doesn't want their opponent to win the sheriff's election, right? It's not just at the presidential level. It happens at these local elections, school board. How long before somebody's wife is the sheriff and she's corrupt and their husband's running for school board. So the sheriff's department arrests and tries to trump up charges against somebody who's running for school board. I think that we as voters have a responsibility to that. And I don't know that we're up to that responsibility. I think that we've demonstrated that we're not. But I think that preventing people with convictions from running for office is a real red flag, right? It's a real red flag about what a true democracy. And yes, we are a democracy, even though we're a constitutional republic, we're still a representative democracy. A true democracy can't do that. They have to trust their voters. And much of what we complain about with the GOP is that they don't trust their voters. They make it so that it's harder to vote. They make congressional districts so that voters have less power. I think that's what we need to be fighting against. And if we can fix that stuff, then the voters are not going to allow, in many cases, the people who should not be in office in office.
The voters are so disenchanted, though. And I do have to say, voting third party or staying home to vote helps the candidate you're least aligned with. It's just the idea of this man having any power again is, I don't even know, like soul crushing. And it's hurtful. We've seen the rise in hate crimes, the rise in xenophobia, the rise in sexism and misogyny and anxiety and depression and all the things, not to mention that a lot of people died under his watch from the pandemic. And that was the first time. That was like on my best behavior, I would think, right? I want to get hired again, so I'm going to give it my all.
And the real danger of it is that when Trump took office in 2016, there were still some Republicans left in the Republican Party. Now there are Trump people in the Republican Party. His cabinet, I don't know if you remember, in 2017, shortly after he took office, right around the time we met, he had his first cabinet meeting and it was televised. And he had them go around the room and each cabinet secretary had to talk about how great Trump was publicly. Now imagine that cabinet. Many of those people have come out directly against Trump. His cabinet that he has now, if he were to be in office, would be Michael Flynn. It would be the guy from Ohio, hillbilly elegy senator. It would be these people who are full-on unqualified, full-on Trumpers, who would have unchecked power. Because we're not going to keep the Senate. There's almost no chance we're going to keep the Senate. Because the math is just what it is. The math is really against us. Like overwhelmingly against us. In a good year, we would have a hard time keeping the Senate. We can only lose one seat. We've already seen Manchin is not running for re-election, which means there's going to be a Republican from West Virginia. Sinema is not running for re-election. We don't know what's going to happen there.
Yeah, Arizona could go red too.
Yeah, and Ben Cardin in Maryland, which has been a traditionally Democratic seat, a very popular former Republican governor, Larry Hogan, is running for that, right? If we just lose those, we're already in a two-seat deficit in the Senate. And there's not a lot of pickup. Michigan is in danger, right? There are a lot of places that don't look great for us right now. And having these people in power is a real threat to us. But I think that what we have to do, and I'm talking about me specifically because I'm really bad at this, but I think we as Democrats and as people on the left are really bad at this. We can't persuade anybody by talking about how terrible Trump is. We can't do it. Everybody knows there is nobody on Trump's side. Not a single Trump voter is going to hear one of us or anybody in the left say, look at what Trump said, look at what Trump did, look at what happened last time, and change their vote.
Do you think that that's just because it is a privilege? You are privileged if you're able to have these conversations because you have the time to watch the news. You have the time to be impacted. I just think about the people who are so busy trying to put food on the table that it's easier for them to latch on to what Trump is selling because he sells it in succinct sound bites.
It's already purchased. He's not getting new voters. What I believe, and I'm going to put on my professor of rhetoric hat here, is that politics more than ever in probably the entirety of our country, possibly immediately before the Civil War, is an expression of identity rather than an expression of ideals. So you're not expressing ideas anymore when you're attacking. Even if you're attacking ideas, you're attacking somebody's identity.
I think one way to think about this is that people have internalized partisan identity maybe in a way that we didn't really see, say, three decades ago.
I do think that things have broken down. I have neighbors that we sort of wave to each other, and that's the extent of our relationship now.
That's a feeling we've heard from our viewers, too, that conversations about current events and politics have become far more divisive and personal.
Your identity as a Trumper is that you are somebody who is MAGA. That is your identity. Attacking Trump is attacking that voter. And that voter, anyone comes and attacks you, how often do you hear somebody attacking and you're like, oh, you got a pretty good point. Our nature is to, in fact, push harder back against that. When we talk about rhetoric, which is speech that's designed to change how people think or act, it has to have a few things for it to work. It has to have a reason for it to happen. It has to have a person talking with a thing to say. But most importantly, it has to have an audience. And the audience has to be capable of doing the thing that the person speaking wants them to do. And so let's say you have a big boulder that rolled into your driveway and you have a toddler there and you say, hey, toddler, go move that boulder. The boulder's not going to move because the toddler is not capable of doing the thing you want them to do. The Trump voter is not capable of hearing our message and believing it because they are now in a world, their frame of reference is so askew from ours that their reality doesn't align. They're not capable of hearing what we have to say as an attack on ideas because they're hearing it as an attack on them. And they know they're not bad people. And so when they hear us attack their identity, they're hearing us attack them, and they know that's not true about them. And therefore, anything we say can't be true. But the good news on this is that we have a coalition that already won. We have a coalition that already won by a lot. Biden beat Trump by 8 million votes. He won in all of the swing states. And what we need to do is to be talking to those people, right? To saying, you've already done this, and your vote mattered, and here's how. This is what happened. We shouldn't be talking about Trump anymore. We all know we're just selling him stuff, and we do it. We do it. I do it. It's natural for us to do it because when you see a bus coming at you, you're like, oh my God, there's a bus coming at me.
I do it a lot less, though, I'll tell you, because I just don't find it interesting.
Yeah, but I do think our messaging needs to be more towards those voters who have stepped away because of single issue, of Israel, of whatever the single issue is that has pushed people away from Biden. We need to remind them of what Biden has achieved because it's a lot. I will tell you, like, when we think about Biden, there's a lot of kind of blah feeling, but he has achieved more than probably any progressive president in my lifetime. He hasn't done everything I want him to do, but he's done a whole hell of a lot. Just the fact that he's landed the economy in a way that people still are getting jobs and spending money and not a depression, which is what maybe was forecast 4 years ago, is miraculous, let alone all of the other stuff that he's done. And we need to be talking about that to the people who already voted for Biden and might not this time.
We should make that the first episode of our good news episodes. Rhetoric, social media, TikTok, all the things that we are discussing obviously intersect right now. Should not be this hard to come out against starving children as a form of war. It shouldn't be hard to come out against rape as a strategy of war. And yet it feels as though social media makes it so difficult.
It's really hard. And I will say, like, you and I have said over and over again at the start of this, that what happened on October 7th was evil, was an act of evil. The Hamas attack into Israel, the taking of hostages, the sexual abuse of hostages, all of that is evil. All of it. But you can be the victim and the perpetrator of great evil. You can be both.
This has gone on for a long time. So when we went in and leveled Kandahar after 9/11, because there was not social media at the time, we were not aware of the suffering and the pain. I mean, we could conceptualize it, but we weren't seeing it. I don't know what happens to this generation when they open Instagram and don't opt in to seeing the human suffering that's going on, but are bombarded with images that our military have to train to see, and then they still are fucked up when they get home. And yet I'm just looking for a cute pair of shoes on Instagram, and I'm faced with these images that burn into my head, and they make me depressed and anxious. And I don't think that the human nervous system is prepared or can take the images that we are seeing right now. Okay, that's A. Okay, that's just the foundation of all of it. And then when you add on that we're all in our echo chambers and people are so one-sided about it all, so one-sided, like they can only see their perspective. And the justification of the amount of killing, like going back to when we were killing civilians, even during that time, you would hear news of like, oh, we were able to kill the second in command of wherever, of whatever terrorist group we were fighting that week. And where are those reports? Has Israel been able to take down anyone from Hamas? My guess is no. My guess is they're not in Gaza.
Yeah, well, I will say there was a report just in the last couple of days that last week Israel may have killed a senior Hamas commander.
May have is not enough to justify the starving of innocent children.
Even if they did, even if they killed every member of Hamas. And frankly, while I care a little bit about that, I don't especially care. I think what Hamas has done is evil and that there's a legitimate war interest in targeting Hamas. But you cannot say that the 32,000 roughly people who have been killed in Gaza, the 75,000 roughly who have been injured, and the 1.1 million who are going to be by July at starvation levels of famine.
Outside a warehouse in Gaza City, crowds of Palestinians clamor for aid. But the meager supplies currently reaching the enclave are nowhere near enough to sustain a population that a UN-backed report says is weeks away from famine. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, said on Monday that it expects famine to hit the north of the Gaza Strip between now and May, and that the number of people experiencing catastrophic hunger has risen to 1.1 million. That's around half of the population.
You cannot say that is an appropriate response to the horrible attacks of October 7th and the hostage taking. It was nowhere near that scale. And if our country was doing this, and I will say our country was doing this in 2001 and 2002, and we were seeing it, we would be screaming against it. And I was screaming against it in 2001 and 2002. I've been really consistent on this. But if you wouldn't tolerate America doing what is happening in Israel and Gaza right now, you cannot tolerate it when either Israel or Hamas does something that's evil. And I am not equating the two because I think it is so... You were a West Wing fan, right? A fan of the West Wing. There's an episode of that show where make-believe terrorist organization shoots down a plane containing a key figure in the show. And Bartlett goes crazy. He wants to level the country where this happened. He wants to turn it into glass. He wants to nuke it. He wants to kill everybody. And the whole military establishment says, no, that's not what we do. They stood up to him. Leo said, I would raise an army against you if you do it. It's a great episode. And what Leo says to him is, this is how it's done. It is fair. It is proportionate. And if they build back what we did, we're going to take them down again next time, but we don't kill these civilians.
We are doing nothing.
We are not doing nothing.
They destroy
4 high-rated military targets.
And this is good?
Of course it's not good. There is no good. It's what there is. It's how you behave if you're the most powerful nation in the world. It's proportional. It's reasonable. It's responsible. It's merciful. It's not nothing. 4 high-rated military targets.
Which they'll rebuild again in 6 months.
Then we'll blow them up again in 6 months. We're getting really good at it.
And where the hell are those people in Israel right now? And if it's not in Israel, where are we in that? Where is Britain in that? Where is France in that? I think that Schumer came out and had what I think was a really powerful speech of Netanyahu needs to face elections. And Netanyahu, prior to October 7th, in my view, should have been in jail. He was a criminal before that. And what's happening now is intolerable. We cannot allow it to stand. And that's not to say that Israel doesn't have a right to defend itself, but this is no longer self-defense. It is not self-defense.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. And I'm terrified to voice my opinion, which I've never been scared to voice my opinion about something, but I've seen too many of my activist friends who have platforms who have spoken out on this issue. You know, it's one of the reasons why I continue to back the NGOs that are on the ground, that are doing this work every single day, that are trying to save lives, because I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I tell you, if the combatants, if the people who want to shoot each other, if they want to get together and shoot each other all day, let them go at it. But we can't let these kids starve. We can't let the hospitals be bombed. And that's as true. We cannot allow indiscriminate rocket strikes into Israel. That can't happen either. You cannot target non-combatants. You just can't do it. And everyone who is doing it is a war criminal. Every single person. Hamas is a war criminal. The people in the IDF who are doing it are war criminals. And there needs to be a reckoning. But more than that, there needs to be a stop. There just absolutely has to be a stop. And I will say to the people who are screaming Free Palestine instead of doing something, I will tell you, and you're not going to vote for President Biden. President Biden is the only candidate who is calling for a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians. The only person who is saying the Palestinians have the right to sovereignty and self-governance in territory that is their own, that they call their own.
I mean, anyone who's not going to vote for Biden and stay home is just fucking dumb. Like, seriously, I get it. But even if Biden can still win without all these votes, which we all know he can, why would you allow those numbers to get closer? Why would you even want to project to the rest of the world that people stayed home? It just does not make any sense to me. That whole like sit down, protest, non-vote, it's so horrible. It's so selfish and it is privileged.
And if you don't vote, you don't get any influence. You lose your influence if you don't vote. Because no one's going to come listen to what you have to say. This is a thing with young voters. We should be paying attention to young voters. But also, young voters vote at the lowest rate of any demographic. And then they say, we don't vote because people don't listen to us. And I get that. I get that frustration. And I believed that when I was in my 20s. And I think we should be listening to young voters and bringing them in regardless. But the reality of the world is no one's going to listen to them until they vote. Until they vote at higher levels than other groups who can then be ignored.
I don't know. I feel that that's like what came first, because in a way, I feel like they would vote if there were policy that actually impacted young people. You know, I think that the things that Biden's doing, like with the Climate Corps, the fact that he opened an office on gun violence prevention, these are all the things that young people care about that I wish we did a better job messaging to the young people.
Because the Climate Corps is a big deal. The Climate Corps is 20,000 jobs where people don't need qualifications.
Of course, the GOP thinks it's dumb because they're bound by the fossil fuel industry. But yeah, it's wild. Okay, I got to go pick up the kids from school now. I don't know if I'm inspired or depressed from this conversation, but I love you.
I love you too.
And thanks everyone for listening.
And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
You have to protect civilians. You have to protect the people who have nothing to do with the fighting. That's the principle that children can understand. When I tell my daughter, I know your brother hit you, but that doesn't mean you could hit him back. I think we can have a very simple message to the Israeli government. I know Hamas committed unspeakable war crimes against Israeli civilians. That doesn't mean you can commit war crimes against Palestinians.
I'm worried, friends. I'm worried about this election. And a lot of that worry has to do with entitlement. Entitlement to the perfect candidate over the good. Entitlement to everything being exactly our way or we're sitting it out. It's early, but the polling is grim. President Biden is trailing in key battleground states. We could see another election where the Democrats win the popular vote, as they have in all but one presidential election since 1992, but still lose the White House. We can't let it happen. We can't let our personal dissatisfaction on issues, even big issues, let Trump back in the White House. Too many other people will be hurt. Too many people died the last time Trump was in office. We can't make this election about ourselves. We just can't. We have to make it about the people who will suffer most, whether they're here in the United States or abroad in places like Gaza, if Trump takes office again. We've got to think about the generations of women who will lose all rights to their bodies in a Trump presidency when he gets to appoint another justice or two to the Supreme Court. This is our responsibility. It rests so firmly on our shoulders, and we just have to take it seriously.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.